And I shouldn't start this way, but some of the questions that were asked a minute ago were really relevant. And because they resonate so strongly with Jyothi's paper, I'll just pick up on Chris's, or Nick's. And it's the idea that there are different types of writing in South Africa. And we tend to focus on a certain kind of writer, but there is a much happier, if you will, popular writing, or a form of popular writing that is more likely to be optimistic, more likely to be escapist, more likely to be not at all interested in happy endings, because they just live a fantasy world. That's the other is the huge growth in crime writing, which again, kind of almost a cliche, but it is a huge area, and by definition, it's not exactly the happiest kind of writing. Yeah. The paper has started one life, which was, I wanted to focus on Dean Gordimer because I long ago, as you might have gathered, I have other accents, other selves beneath this one. And my first one was Mozambican. My second one was South African. I moved to South Africa when I was 20 and picked up the language. And when she died, Nadine Gordimer, a while back, a friend sent me the obituary. And I thought, yeah, well, I have a lot to be grateful to her. She taught me English because her books were so easy to read. They created the most amazing world mirror image to South Africa. To South Africa that was beautiful, ugly, contradictory, and in a sense, she created a reality that I could relate to. But more importantly, politically, she took me from a Portuguese migrant in South Africa, by definition right-wing, to someone who could see South Africa differently, to the point where I ended up at the gate at some point 6 years later. So Gordimer has a lot of significance for me. The book that really brought me to this paper was her latest book, No Time Like the Present, which I think is a wonderful, wonderfully ironic title because, of course, there is no title like the present. It's the most banal cliche you can come up with. But simultaneously, in South Africa, there is no time like the present. And she quotes Kogat Zile, the poet, at the beginning of the book to point out that despair is a luxury and cynicism is a luxury that South Africans should not indulge in. You have to be critical of the country in its present day, in the present. But you must not overdo it, if you will, because you must look back to the trajectory that South Africa has undertaken. And it's that moment of transition that every one of her novels has looked at. Transition towards a better future, a fairer society, a more just society. For white people in particular, a society in which whites might feel and be accepted as Africans. And I think, so transition for me has always been at the heart of her work. Now, having said that, the paper will end up being primarily about No Time Like the Present, because it is a contradictory novel. Gillian Slovo thought it was a fantastic novel, and clearly Gillian Slovo is a fan. I quoted her in my abstract because she's been a fan of Gordimer for a long time. I'm a fan of Gordimer, but I do think that this novel raises a whole range of issues about the post-apartheid South Africa and the post-democracy South Africa. In the sense you mentioned earlier, I think, historical reportage. So it suggests there's a degree of journalistic narrative that increasingly novelists seem to draw on as a way of not necessarily memorializing the present, but kind of recording what is happening as a counter history. South Africa has not yet entered the Zimbabwean phase, so to speak, but there is not much room for dissent, or there isn't as much room for dissent as people thought there was going to be. And I think there is a fear sometimes that some truths are getting lost, some stories are not going to be told. Gordimer's novel is this assertion of stories about corruption, about xenophobia, about also lies, deceit that must be told. And it's kind of there's an urgency in her novel that comes with what I'm calling a shorthand aesthetic, almost a crude narrative in the sense that it's just throwing things on the page and let you make up your mind about it. So this story must not get lost. Kind of thinking back to Toni Morrison, this is a story to pass on. This is not a story to pass on. It's the kind of the ambiguity that I was interested in. Now, I suspect I have 30 minutes or 20 minutes? 30 minutes. I had worked on 20, so I'll go slower. Okay, if I go fast just before lunch. The other thing is, as you said, I just came off the flight, and I realized that the more tired I am, the more of an accent I have, and the more of a kind of an exhausted look I begin to develop in my speech. So that might be the performance you get as well. All the writer can do, Gordon claims in A Writer's Freedom, is to go on writing the truth as he sees it. That is what I mean by his private view of events, whether they be the great public ones of wars and revolutions or the individual and intimate ones of daily personal life. End of quote. Gordimer always uses he pronoun, never bothered with gender neutral language. And in fact, kind of claimed not to be a feminist, so let's not get too carried away about her choice of language. Gordimer goes on to say that some stories, and I quote again, I have gone on writing again and again all my life, not so much because the themes are obsessional, but because I found ways to take hold of them, because I hoped to make the revelation of new perceptions through the different techniques these demand. End of quote. Again, that's anyone familiar with her work. There's a repetition. There's a kind of, she says it's not obsessional. I think it is obsessional. It was obsessional. The way she returned to the same themes, the same types of characters, the same pairings of characters. Yet it would be possible to see the treatment of an intellectualized commitment to change and transformation deeply rooted in the materiality of life in South Africa as an obsession with the demands on the self and on the artist and the persistent internal conflict at the heart of white identities and especially of the artist pre and post apartheid. So what role, elsewhere she says, what role is there for the white, first for the writer, but secondly for the white writer in South Africa, because the story she or he makes up, as in tells, is quite irrelevant to the majority of the people, as you pointed out earlier, very often illiterate at the level of being able to read a novel. Change and transformation, the transition between ages, between ways of being and states of consciousness, are intrinsic to the story of a couple, importantly of black and white descent, faced with the challenges of adapting to life post-struggle, that Gordimer tells in No Time Like the Present. Hence, I want to come back to that. Klingman spoke, and again, Dorothy brought up Stephen Klingman's second book, or later book, but the book that he first wrote about Klingman was History from the Inside, famously suggested that all her novels were a version of history of South Africa, that again, as the point I made earlier, was the history that could not be written officially. So the novelist took up the call to tell the other story that was being suppressed, repressed. Klingman spoke of Gordimer as, I quote, an interpreter of South Africa, as over the years her country has marched down its doom-ridden slope of apartheid. Inside the tragedy, Gordimer's voice has been a voice of conscience, of moral rigor, and of a clarified hope, end of quote. Again, if you're familiar with her nonfiction, you would know how often she has returned to these themes, the rigor of, the demands for rigor for the on the artist in societies such as South Africa in particular, and the artist is a white person. Indeed, abroad, as in overseas, her voice has spoken with a degree of authority that was inherent in the sense of betrayal of her racial group, so her betrayal of the white group to which she belonged, as it were. Self-abnegation affirming the narrative voice and vision. Newman's famous apologia for Pro Vita Sua often has been used by critics to refer to Gordimer's work, or her oeuvre, I think a better way of referring to it, in the sense that her work is so intertwined with the person, the individual, the artist, and the psychic self. The latter, an especially apt term to refer to the intertwining, as I say, of artist and self. In his introduction to the essay collection, The Essential Gesture, Klingman, in 1998, pointed out that, and I quote, the book concerns nothing less than Gordimer's sense of identity. It is hard to dispute how deeply the concern with a white or a white or a South African identity is part of an overt and, as Gordimer saw it, a politically committed and meaningful attempt to being white in South Africa. In that sense, it is also, however, unwittingly, a narrative rehabilitation of whiteness as an identity category in South Africa. And I speak as someone, as I said, who left in 86 and has never gone back not to live. So I'm very aware that white South Africans who stayed behind made a particular decision that often was perfectly justified and justifiable. Apologia pro Vita Sua is in this context the means of an ameliorative project that her writing, her fiction and nonfiction, and her actions during and after the official end of apartheid articulated. Again, there is a lot about how perhaps she put herself at risk during apartheid, how since then she's gone out of her way to support people in certain ways that others, other white people, chose not to do. There's a very conscious way of being in the country. The self in process, the self in progress, is at the core of her work. The healing or therapeutic dimension of the writing returns in the persistent iteration of themes and topics, of political tropes, even of characters, of pairings of characters. They are predominantly, but not exclusively, white. And again, in the latest book, she returns to a pairing of white-black that she first explored in Occasion for Loving, but then much later in another one of her books, which completely escapes me now. But so it's again, it's a recurring theme in her work in trope. They are predominant. Sorry, lost something here. As the writer herself assiduously asserted, Gordimer's prolific career is thoroughly inflected by an intense preoccupation with the writer's responsibility, and the white writer's responsibility, most of all, in a society such as South Africa. In A Writer's Freedom, Gordimer asserts that, and I quote, in a certain sense, a writer is selected by his subject being the consciousness of his era. And she underlines the word consciousness herself. And again, the echoes of Jameson's The Political Unconscious are quite interesting here, as they are of Freud's work and the idea of the repressed, which again, if you're familiar with Gordimer's work, there are lots of, you used earlier the phrase, unfinished business. There's a lot of unfinished business in her novels. The body that shows up in The Conservationist and appears quite early in the book, then disappears and returns at the end of the book. That kind of, that is what I'm trying to evoke through the use of haunting, that constant sense of unfinished business. And unfinished business because for someone like her who believes in a different future, and I don't mean by to say a better future, a different future, it can only ever be a process. It cannot be a finite end to any change. So I invoke the motive of haunting in my abstract, rather loosely, as an attempt to identify the obsessional and obsessive treatment of certain themes in her work. Reading her novels across a career spanning 50 years is to be struck by the similarity of her concerns, but indeed the singularity of her vision. And by singular here, I mean perhaps erroneously, but allow me my multicultural, multilingual confusion, I want to read singular here both as distinct and referring to number. So distinct, unique, but also quite the one coming back to. In Gordimer, the haunting emerges thus in the recurrence of themes of change and transformation, for example, of transition from an oppressed and damaged society to a free and healing one. Interestingly, too, while transition, posited at first as an act of necessary but justified and resolvable period of violence, the interregnum she spoke of repeatedly in her work via Gramsci, emerges in Gordimer's most recent novels as much less stable and defined than earlier works suggested. In part, the crisis is a constant in the white South African self, whatever the position on post-apartheid South Africa. As she reiterates in her last novel, No Time Like the Present, the surprising identity twist that has now ensnared white liberal South Africans is the persistence of the doubt about belonging in South Africa. And what I mean to say is that previously, people like her felt that perhaps they had no right to be in that country unless they fought for a changed society. Having achieved it, the central character in No Time Like the Present, Steve Reed, eventually does what a lot of South Africans did, especially the conservative ones against whom he fought. They migrate to Australia, or they at least go all the way about getting a presidency in Australia. As one of those who did the same, I'm not going to get too carried away, but suffice it to say, if you haven't read the book, she does get her facts about Australia a little bit wrong, put it nicely. In The Essential Gesture, the essay in the book by the same title, Gordimer quotes approvingly the words of the great, and I quote, the great mentor of 19th century Russian revolutionary writers, Belinsky, do not worry about the incarnation of ideas. If you are a poet, and here she means it, if you are an artist, if you're a poet, your works will contain them without your knowledge. Again, the consciousness being picked up, called up by the consciousness of your country. If you are a poet, your works will contain them without your knowledge. They will be both moral and national if you follow your inspiration freely. Unsure that she's trying hard enough, perhaps convinced that she's not doing it, she writes elsewhere that I was a coward and no doubt often shall be one again in my actions and statements as a citizen of the interregnum. And again, it's quite ironic. If she was a coward, what were the rest of us who lived there as well? Gordimer opts for investing in the writing, the ability to do the work she, as an individual white South African, cannot achieve. So that's where the fiction and the self, again, are completely intertwined. It's the writing. It's the means she has. It's the weapon she has to make things happen. She herself is not up to the task. So a concern with ideas characterizes both the politics and the poetics of Gordimer's writing. For she cannot contemplate stories without a purpose, without an aim, without a lesson. And there's a great deal of didacticism in her work that can be frustrating, that can be irritating, because she can be both, she can write beautiful sentences and at the same time write sentences that just hammer you over the head until you get the message that you must be a better person. And this is completely wrong. And again, No Time Like the Present is perhaps worse than others, but I think she does it self-knowingly. Ideas more or less subtly intertwined with the story impel the narrative, whether in the lyricism of the conservationist or, for example, or in the paratactic intensity of the house gun, very short sentences, very over-narrated story that, as a reader, you are forced to try to understand not just the story, so coming back to Dorothy's comment about reading for plot, but reading about why she writes in the way she's writing. What does that say about the consciousness of a time, the urgency of a time, the time at which she is writing? They are fundamental to the way in which, for Gordimer, ideas must not only inhabit the writing, but also be clearly visible in the reading. Okay? So they must not just be there. As readers, we must get the message. We must get what she wants to get across to us. And again, who is this we? Who is this us whom she's trying to address? As a white South African writer, she believes herself bound to a social category that determines how her novels are read. To whom are South African writers in their, white South African writers in their essential gesture, if they are not in the historical and the existential situation of blacks, and if they are alienated from their own, inverted commas, the historical and existential situation of whites? So where does she belong? So coming back down then to No Time Like the Present. No Time Like the Present, published in 2012, was reviewed by Slovo as a fantastic book, beautifully written, very successful book. The reviewer in the Statesman in the UK, likewise, was very complimentary, not quite as supportive as Slovo. The novel is utterly typical of the novel of social biography and of political commitment that defined the whole of Gordimer's work, a narrative in which the story, the characters, the setting principally are devices that enable the writer to narrate yet another phase of South Africa's long walk to freedom. And what she does, if you, again, are familiar with her work, and Slovo highlights it, she kind of maps out historical period. See, she maps out phases looking back of the struggle, so to speak. And the fact that she capitalizes the struggle throughout no time like the present, I think, is symptomatic of her sense that she was working on a historical project, so to speak. Each novel was about a moment in history that it's kind of then framed, wrapped up, not always optimistic, but not always pessimistic either. It's highly critical. That's the whole point of it. Set in the ways, kind of the dying days of Mbeki's regime and the ascent to power of Jacob Zuma, Mandela barely figures, other than as this kind of ghostly figure of what might have been, what Mandela represented, what his society, a society he informed, might have been like. In contrast, of course, she juxtaposes Zuma's, which, as we have come to know, and again, I'm afraid I'm going to digress, I think white South Africans have a particular problem with Zuma in a way that black South Africans are not as haunted by it. Zuma, as you know, believed and believes probably still that if you have shower, AIDS will not touch you, as in if you have a shower after sex, that rape is something you do because the woman was sufficiently aroused, as he put it. And in Zulu society, I just have to do it. So there was a whole range of almost farcical, absurd ways in which he justified his actions, which the novel meticulously brings to the fore. Okay. So if there is one person who's constantly being attacked throughout the novel, it is Zuma. Now Zuma, whether we like it or not, or South Africans like, he's the president of South Africa. She does, or the novel suggests then, that there is one South Africa, the Mandela one, and again Dorothy alluded to this earlier, there was one version, one section of black South African society who saw Mandela in certain ways. Young people perhaps didn't see him quite in the same way. And I think in many ways Zuma is appealing to a different constituency that, yes, does not please perhaps the white South African most of all. So the white couple, Jabulele, the black woman, and Stephen Reed, black and white, both met in Swaziland. If you know your geography, tiny little country at the bottom, Mozambique, caught up between South Africa, where they were exiled in the struggle. And so that they have this joint history, and they're now living in democratic South Africa. What the novel kind of simplistically kind of rehearses is the way in which the democratic neoliberal South Africa now co-opts these radical idealistic couple. They fought for freedom, they fought for the struggle. Now they are perfectly, not perfectly, Jabulele in particular resists it, but goes along with Steve's desire to get a better school for their girl, to get a better, safer suburb to live in, and so on and so forth. So the way the novel suggests their life evolves is kind of increasingly middle class, increasingly ordinary, increasingly anything but radical. However, because we have to get the lesson that the novel wants to put across, both eventually retrain, having come back from the revolution with some skills no longer particularly useful in this society. Steve now joins academia and becomes a university lecturer. His role, in a kind of Althusserian mode, is to change the apparatus. It's to change the whole education system. It's to make it possible for poor black people to go to university. Conversely, Jabulele retrains as a lawyer, and her job becomes, both, you will not be surprised, they're extremely good at their jobs. How else could they change the system? She becomes fundamental, kind of pivotal, to the process of change of the justice system, because it too is completely corrupt by the previous system. So again, without going into the idea of transitional justice that many of you have already picked up, I think there is a degree to which the fundamental change she perceives in South Africa touches on this transitional justice. What she sees is South Africa has to be changed from the ground up, and figures like Steve and Jabulele become spearheads for the kind of new thinking that is required. New thinking, new courage, and new actions. So South Africa will be populated by people like them, and that's and they will be the people who will change what has not really changed at all, despite the official end of apartheid. Okay. And that's, again, the point the novel repeatedly points out, makes. If I make the narrative process sound rather mechanical, I suggest that Gornema herself treats it thus, impatiently providing a sufficiently dense but also fairly basic body of information, of knowledge, that is both important to the stories being told and already very well known to most her readers. Okay. And again, that's where perhaps the contradiction or the tension between a local reader and an overseas reader and how we perceive the novel might be interesting to look at. So the second chapter opens thus. There was a Pleistocene age, there was a Bronze Age, an Iron Age. The sense of urgency, time is passing, time is passing. Elsewhere, there is a reference to the Mbeki age, Tom Mbeki, the second president. And at one point, we read, weeks have gone by, months. Crude passing of time, if you will. It's not the most elegant, the most fictional way of narrating the passage of time. This kind of narrative, self-consciously overblown and afraid of showing off its crude shorthand aesthetic, denotes both the urgency of recording the story of the present and the cautious, subtly or softly ironic critique of the period beyond the struggle that the novel undertakes. So it is important, she asserts, not to forget that the present is not perfect. There is no time like the present, but let us not get over-optimistic about what we have achieved. Attention to the period of transition, of change and transformation, brings into play the unfinished business of apartheid South Africa, post-apartheid, both for the nation and for the writer. She is caught, as a writer, her characters are caught, between affirming and celebrating the radically transformed nature of the present and acknowledging the increasingly visible imperfections that tarnish. And much is made of xenophobia and the shame of xenophobia. Now, again, Dorothy pointed out earlier through Rob Nixon, the shame of xenophobia in South Africa, and the novel brings it up, is crucially connected with poverty. That's one of the characters points out in the novel. It's not xenophobia, perhaps, it's poverty. So it's not that black South Africans inherently dislike other Africans. Is that they are competing for the meager resources available to them. So critical of the present, she's very much aware of the luxury that is despair. The present, we read early in the work, was not a miracle, but a hard-fought reality. I quote, Stephen and Jabu Lili, referred in the novel as Jabu, live a normal life, not a miracle. It was made by human struggle. In the words of one of the two epigraphs she uses, which I referred to earlier, though the present remains a dangerous place to live, cynicism would be a reckless luxury. And that's Gotsi Klile, the poet. Ultimately, this is a conversation among like-minded people, those who came through apartheid only because they believed in a better, fairer, and more just future. Faced with the brevity of Nelson Mandela's reign, Thabo Mbeki's embrace of more or less neoliberal political ideology, and Jacob Zuma's growing sense of megalomania, Gordimer's characters waver in their commitment to the post-struggle South Africa, the post-struggle present. And the other person referred to in the novel is Malema, the leader of the ANC Youth League, who has been known for particularly strong, virulent statements against white South Africans. And for many is seen as potentially a replacement for Zuma at some point. Again, the novel rehearses that as what if? What if he were the person who takes over from Zuma? So rather than admitting defeat, though, she rehearses in the novel a more hopeful narrative of the nation. In this way, No Time Like the Present reiterates Gordimer's long letter to South Africa, embodied in the whole of her work, that Apologia pro Vita Sua. There is no time like the present, because the kind of lives the novel depicts would not have been possible during apartheid and without the struggle, no matter how flawed they might be. So the There is no time like the present, because even with corruption and deceit and political opportunism, this world is an improvement on the past. The irony, which the author acknowledges in the self-knowing refusal to give in to pessimism and cynicism, is that for white people such as Steve and the gay man who live next door to him, and Jabulele, and if you haven't read the novel, Steve and Jabulele move into a house where four young gay men live. And the whole thing becomes kind of a cliche again, the rainbow nation in all sorts of ways, a group of people who get on because they are different, they are radical. They could not have had this kind of life in the past. And that's something that is really important in the novel. So Steve and the gay men who live next door to him and Jabulele, and their black friends Jake and Isa, the present is distinct essentially because it enables them to choose how to live their whiteness. And that's my take. Gillian Slovo makes the point in her review that this is a novel about choice, where Steve and Jabulele will be able and will have choices, no matter how flawed those choices are. My take here is that, as we see in the character of Steve, and he goes all the way to get residency in Australia. At the end, he, of course, opts for not going because that's the commitment. But that is something perhaps Steve would not have ever thought available to him, the choice to go elsewhere. During apartheid, he knew there was no other place to go. His responsibility, his duty was to change the system, was to fight for a better world. Beyond that, he begins to contemplate leaving. And that's much, again, Jabulele just goes along, but the novel makes much of this contradiction. Before, he would never have dreamed of leaving. He left as an exile. But afterwards, he himself begins to make that choice. So again, I'm reading it as a comment on the idea of belonging as a white person in this new nation. And as I said earlier, this is tied up with Malema's pronouncements and the what if. What if Malema were the replacement for Zuma in the future? So for much of the second half of the book, the novel plays on the paradox of a man such as Steve, who early on committed his life to human rights and the fight against apartheid, considering leaving the South Africa for which he fought, one which, with or without irony, there is no time like the present. So echoing Gordimer's views on writing and ideas, no time like the present is less fiction than a fictionalized account of the political machinations in South Africa since Mandela exited the political stage. It is both, and this is my passing reference to your call for papers, it is both a memoir and a necessary rehearsal of the recent history. It's a necessary rehearsal of the recent history because, again, Dorothy pointed out earlier, so much is not, is forgotten. And first speaker, I arrived at the end of your paper, but again, you were talking about amnesiac and the notion of national collective amnesia. From Mandela, but almost without touching upon a period treated almost unanimously in South Africa as characterized by hope, integrity, and fairness, the novel skims equally lightly over Mbeki's regime, though bemoaning failed opportunities and commenting scathingly on Mbeki's own inability to commit to the fight against AIDS. No Time finally alights on Zuma's ascent to power. As I said, it is then that I think it becomes perhaps too contradictory for my own take, because it is as if Zuma just has to be demonized. The man needs no help. He will do the job himself. The novel is determined to pick up every court case in which he was involved, every act of corruption in which he was involved, every act of sexual violence in which he was involved, as if this man has to be crucified. It's kind of overkill at the end. And that's where the journalistic takes over. So change and transformation are as much about the new vocabulary of the Constitution, grandiose and hopefully normative as it is, as about a remaking of social and psychic sensibilities. And I think this is where she comes back to the idea that if the leader of the country is not that person, is not the person capable of driving that change and transformation, what hope is there for the present? But again, I was taken with Dorothy's comment about one of the questions put the need or the urge or the desire for happy endings, and to what extent that is in the novel, to what extent that is the readers impose them. That's something that I think Gordimer herself leaves open. Okay? She does make choices for her characters, but ultimately this is a cautiously optimistic novel. Okay? This, at the end, you do not see this person walking out. At the end, you see this person staying on to fight for that struggle that is yet unfinished business. So there is no giving up. There is no leaving. Rather than confuse you any further, I'm going to come back to this idea of, in her second letter from Johannesburg, 1985, these are two letters from Johannesburg, one, I can't remember, just 76, so after Soweto, June Soweto, the other in 1985, she asserts, young people like these, and she's talking about white people, are aware that a change of consciousness of the white sense of self has to be achieved along a longer change of regime. If, when blacks do sit down to consult with whites, there is anything to talk about. Now, again, the echoes of Steve Biko's own book. We'll come and talk to you when we're ready for it, but we will determine the terms of that conversation. Interesting here. No Time offers an obliquely imagined answer to this concern, as Stephen's closeness to black South Africans nevertheless failed to root him in the new South Africa in a way that make him settled, that allow him to settle, although he will come back to make the decision to stay, just as the family has been allowed to emigrate to Australia. This is neither an easy decision nor a particularly convincing one in the book, I think. So at the end, the artist's courage I highlighted throughout her career is something that I think she brings to this novel in the decision that Steve will have to make about staying or leaving, and to what extent that means a future in South Africa with someone like Malema, and you then put up with what will come, or whether you will engage in the dissenting culture that will fight the increasingly narrow regime available through Zuma and through eventually Malema. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.